Well, again, it's good to see everyone here. I hope everyone is doing well. I know that we're all doing well at our house, and hope that everybody is staying healthy. It's good to see a few out that maybe have not been able to be with us before, and we're delighted to see everybody here. As Tom mentioned, remember next Sunday, we'll go back to our full schedule of services. We'll be here for Bible study at 9 o'clock. And then the 24th, I guess, we'll resume our Wednesday Bible studies as well. So I'm looking forward to that very, very much. For the lesson this morning, I'd like to dig into a Bible topic that, I don't know, it's kind of hard to describe in some ways. It is a biblical topic that in some ways is kind of mysterious, because even though it is something the Bible talks about, there are parts of this topic that are not very clear to us, that the Bible does not describe in detail. And yet it seems to me, as especially I read the New Testament, that this picture, for which we don't have all the details, turns out to be pretty important to know. It is kind of a big picture lesson that I plan to share with you this morning. We're not going to be looking at one particular text in the Bible this morning, as we often do. But there is this large scene, this big picture, that I think is very important to understanding the biblical story. I do believe that if we have a sense of this picture as much as we can grasp of it, that it helps us tremendously to understand the point of the Bible and the purpose of the Bible. It helps us to understand why it is that God has told us what he has told us, and the point and the goal of all it is that we are doing. For me, I find those kinds of things to be very useful. Because I do believe that a lot of people in this old world, when they pick up their Bibles, they read it in kind of a piecemeal fashion. And they may know this part and they may know that part. And this verse may sound familiar to them, and that verse may be one that they had memorized at one time. But what about putting it all together? What about seeing the picture? I think that is tremendously important. And so what I'd like to do is spend just a few moments this morning thinking about this picture. And again, I do so with the caveat that there are parts of this picture that the Bible doesn't describe. There are parts of this picture that the Bible describes very mysteriously. But I do believe that there is enough of it there for us to investigate. Our study this morning is going to begin at the very beginning in the book of Genesis in chapter 1. And we're not going to read that text, and we're not going to go through that text in detail, but I just simply want to get your mind back to that text. Genesis chapter 1 and the story of the beginning. In the beginning are the first words of the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, of course, we realize that there are all kinds of things that you and I might have questions about that are never mentioned in Genesis chapter 1. For example, because of our ability to build telescopes and other things like that, we have a sense of the greatness of the universe in which we live, the existence of galaxies and solar systems and nebulae and all those things out there. The Bible doesn't mention a thing about those in detail, at least. There are other questions about how certain things happened and were done that are not addressed by this text. And we come to realize that Genesis chapter 1 is never really meant to be a comprehensive explanation of everything that we might think about or discover in the universe. That it is a beginning, it is a way to tell the beginning of the story that concerns you and me. There are lots of other things that perhaps could have been told, that God could have gone into detail about, but those are things that are really not germane or important to the story that the Bible wants to tell us. And what we have here is not all of the story, but the story, the beginning of the story of man. And so we read here about God creating this world, specifically this planet, and how God made it the way that it was. And then at the end, when it was all prepared, everything was in place, everything was alive and beautiful, God made man, and you know the story as well as I do, that God put man and woman in this beautiful place in the garden. But in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 1, we read a little detail there. And that is part of this picture that we want to look at this morning. It says in chapter 2 and verse 1, "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, and all their hosts." Now, it's possible, I suppose, to think of the hosts there as stars and planets, but normally that word refers to other beings. And what the Bible is telling us there is that, yes, God created the heavens and the earth. He made the world and the mountains and the seas and the trees and all the animals. But God had also created other beings that live not on the earth but in the heavenly realm. He had created what the Bible calls the heavenly host. All kinds of what we might perhaps call spiritual beings, or perhaps more accurately, heavenly beings. So, for example, we read in the Bible about angels. We read about creatures as in Isaiah chapter 6, about the seraphim. We read about creatures that are called cherubs. If you've ever read Revelation chapter 4, you know that around the throne of God are these things that John simply calls living creatures, because there's really nothing else that he can call them. There are all kinds of beings who live in the heavenly realm. In Psalm 33, for example, we hear this discussed in some other places in the Bible. In Psalm 33, the author says in verse 6, "By the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth all their host." And so God created the place, and he created all of the beings as well. In the book of Job, we hear some kind of glimpses of this, as Job and God are having their discussion in Job chapter 38. You remember, this is the point where God breaks into the scene and begins to ask Job some questions. And listen to what God says in Job 38, starting in verse 4. "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth?" So God goes all the way back to the creation story there. Let's go back to the beginning. "Job, where were you when I was doing all of that? Tell me if you have understanding. Who set its measurements, since you know? Or who stretched the line on it? On what were its bases sunk? Who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy?" Now that phrase, "sons of God," is a typical phrase in the Old Testament to describe angels. So listen to what God is saying to Job, that all the angels were there watching as God created the heavens and the earth. God says, "I was there laying out the line, stretching the line, sinking the bases, laying the cornerstone, and all of the angels were rejoicing as I did it." Were you there to see that, Job? And so we have this picture of something going on in the heavenly realm that Genesis really doesn't talk much about. It says there in chapter 2 and verse 1 that God created all their hosts, and that's it. Moses moves on. But there is this developing picture we see in these texts of this great population of heavenly beings. Now, there's another part of the creation story that actually turns out to be kind of important for this picture. You are familiar with the fact, back there in the book of Genesis, that as God is creating everything, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and we're told the earth was formless, void, and dark. There was no light, and there was no form to anything. That there was matter, there was water, there was air, everything was all mixed together. And the picture we get in Genesis 1 is then God goes about organizing it. So for example, in Genesis 1 and verse 6, God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the expanse, that is, he made the sky, so that there is water above and there is water below. And he separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening and there was morning a second day. And then God said, "Let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear." So get the picture that on that first day, God makes a space of air, the heavens. But here on the earth, everything is still all mixed together. And so God says, okay, now we're going to separate the dry land from the water. The seas have to go into their place, and the dry land will then appear. And it was so, and God called the dry land earth, and the gathering of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. It is actually kind of surprising, as I was studying for this lesson, how often the Bible talks about this kind of activity on the part of God. For example, if you want to go back there to the book of Job, where we were a moment ago in Job chapter 38, as God continues there in verses 4 through 7, or the passage where we just were there, God talks there about stretching the line. And of course, the idea is setting a boundary, that God made lines, just like a worker would stretch the line, that here's where the wall is going to be, here's where this is going to be, here's... God was doing that in his creative activity. If you'll go down to verse 8, "Who enclosed the sea with doors? When bursting forth, it went out from the womb. When I made a cloud its garment, and thick darkness its swaddling band, and I placed boundaries on it, and set a bolt and doors. And I said, thus far you shall come, but no farther. And here your waves will stop." God said, "I took the seas and I put them in a place, and I locked the door, as it were, and I made the sea stay where it is." Were you there when I did that, Job? The point is that God made boundaries. If you turn just over a few more pages in your Bible from that place in Psalm 104, Psalm 104 in verse 9, here's the psalmist says, again, speaking about the creation in verse 5, "He established the earth on its foundations." Verse 6, "You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled, and at the sound of your thunder they hurried away. The mountains rose, the valleys sunk, the place that you established for them, and you set a boundary that they may not pass over, so that they will not return to cover the earth." God made boundaries. God made a boundary for the sea in particular. And we hear Jeremiah speak about this in Jeremiah chapter 5 and other places. But the boundaries for the sea are not the only boundaries that God makes. As the story goes on in the Bible, and God eventually brings things into existence, we have a really interesting statement in Deuteronomy 32 and verse 8. This is what's sometimes called the Song of Moses, as he is talking to Israel about the God that they serve. And notice what he says there, Deuteronomy 32 and verse 8, when the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of man, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the sons of Israel. Now, there's something going on in this text that I think is kind of interesting, because what does that mean? It says that he set their boundaries according to the number of the sons of Israel. Well, the Greek translation of this passage, which is actually older than the Hebrew text that we have here, says that God set their boundaries according to the sons of God. And that makes a lot more sense. What Moses is saying there is that, you remember back there in Genesis 10 and 11, at the Tower of Babel, when God scatters everybody and makes them go all over the earth, that God divides mankind and each one has a different language now? Moses is saying that God divided them, separated them, and set their boundaries according to the number of angels he had made. And the biblical picture that develops later on is that there is an angel who oversees each nation of people. And so the plot kind of thickens. We hear this thought going on in some other places as well. For example, in Psalm 74 and in verse 17, you established the boundaries of the earth. And the Apostle Paul, as he was preaching, you remember, in Acts chapter 17 in the city of Athens. You remember what Paul said there in Acts 17 and in verse 26, that God made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth and determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. Part of this picture that we have in the book of Genesis is, first of all, that God made all of these spiritual beings. But as God was making everything, he was also setting boundaries. And it turns out that boundaries are pretty important things, because boundaries are for order, and boundaries are for protection. And so we read later on, for example, that as God is about to give the land to Israel, the promised land, this is what God says in Exodus chapter 23 concerning that land. Notice the way that God speaks about it. Exodus 23 and verse 31, I will fix your boundary from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines and from the wilderness to the river Euphrates, and I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you will drive them. Notice that God says, I'm going to make a boundary for you, that you're going to be in your rightful place, and the nations are going to be in their place. And just like God made the waters stay in its place, that God is creating order here. Because what is warfare, if you think about it? What is warfare? It's when one nation crosses the boundary of another. It's when there is an invasion of one people into the place of another. And that's what creates warfare. That's what creates death, destruction, and all kinds of chaos. And the biblical picture is that God, in his ordering of the world, put things where they are for safety and order. And so there is this kind of big picture that is slowly developing, that God is the maker of heaven and earth, and there are beings that live in heaven and there are beings that live on the earth. Now, the Bible emphasizes that second part, right? What goes on the earth, because this book was written for us. This book was not written for angels for them to read. It was written about us and our history. And so this book concentrates on what goes on the earth, but we realize from these other passages that there is this heavenly realm, that there are beings there as well, and that the heavenly beings serve God in heaven, and earthly beings serve God on the earth. And there is a boundary. And that's the way that God made it. That's the order of things, the way it is supposed to be. And for some period of time, and I have no idea of how long it was, that situation persisted. But then the Bible tells us that everything changed. At some point, and the Bible does not tell us exactly when this happened, if I am reading the Bible correctly, and that's a big if, but if I am reading this text correctly, it seems to me that the Bible implies that this change of things happened before Genesis chapter 3, somewhere between Genesis chapter 2 and chapter 3. And what happened is that a rebellion broke out in heaven. There was a rebellion in heaven. That one of God's creatures that he made to live in heaven, one of these spiritual beings, decided that he was not going to obey God any longer, that he was not going to submit to God's rule, that he wanted to follow his own way and follow his own desires because he had his own plans for how he wanted things to be. And this being, this rebel being, is known in the Bible as Satan, or sometimes simply the devil. We hear again a very sketchy, very minimalistic report of this in some Bible passages. So, for example, in Revelation chapter 12, at the very end of the Bible, as John is kind of painting this big picture, he says there in verse 7 that there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. And we're told later on in verse 9 that this dragon is none other than the devil and Satan. That there was a war that went on in that heavenly realm. There are some faint echoes of this, I think, in two places in the Old Testament, and one of them is Ezekiel chapter 28. Now, Ezekiel 28, I think the whole book of Ezekiel is a difficult book, and we're not going to go into detail this morning, but here in Ezekiel chapter 28, it says in verse 1 that what the prophet is about to say is about the king of Tyre. But if I understand this text again correctly, what I think that God is saying about the king of Tyre in this text is that he has kind of followed in the footsteps of another rebellion. That this proud, arrogant king has done something that is exactly like what Satan had done. Look at Ezekiel 28, starting in verse 12. You had the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, in the garden of God. Now, the king of Tyre was not in the garden of Eden. But you were, God says about this, and every precious stone was your covering. And in verse 14, you were the anointed cherub who covers, and I placed you there, and you were on the holy mountain of God, and you walked in the midst of the stones of fire. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until unrighteousness was found in you. I think what we have there in that text is an echo of this story about the war in heaven. That this being was something like a cherub, a great spiritual being that was in the presence of God that decided to rebel against God. We have a similar text like that. We won't go and look at that this morning, but in Isaiah chapter 14, we have another example of this. And again, the details are sketchy, and probably rightly so. I mean, it doesn't really matter to me how all of this happened. I might be interested in knowing the details, but that's not the point of my life, right? But we read later on, for example, Jesus says in Matthew 25 and verse 41 that hell has been prepared for the devil and his angels. And so there is this picture, if we kind of connect the dots, that not only did Satan rebel against God, but he began to recruit other heavenly beings. That he recruited some angels and convinced them to join on his side. And this is why Satan appears in Genesis chapter 3. That's kind of the backstory of Genesis chapter 3. Because when you turn to Genesis chapter 3, there is this serpent in the garden. And what is he doing? He's trying to recruit God's creatures on earth to be on his side. He comes to Eve and says, "Does God tell you you can't do anything? Why don't you do it my way? Why don't you follow your own desires? Let me show you how it's done and come over to my side." And you know the story as well as I do that Eve decides to do that and then Adam does as well. And so the picture is that Satan is recruiting opposition in heaven and on earth to join his rebellion. And you'll notice what else has happened there, that Satan has crossed the boundary, that he is a heavenly being and he should be in heaven, but he is now on the earth. You remember in the book of Job that there is that strange conversation between God and Satan, that the sons of God are being presented before God, the angels, and the devil shows up in that great assembly and God says, "What are you doing here and where have you been?" And Satan says, "Oh, I've been down on the earth. I've been scoping out that place," because he wants Job to be on his side too, just like Adam and Eve. And then what happens next in the Bible really is not surprising if you're following this story, that in Genesis chapter 6, there is nothing less than a full-scale invasion of the earth by this rebellious army. It says in Genesis 6 and verse 1 that men began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them. And the sons of God, who are those sons of God? Those are angels. They saw that the daughters of men were beautiful and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. And so they have crossed the boundary. They have left their heavenly abode. They have come to earth. And the picture, the implication is that these are not good angels. These are not angels who are just curious about life on earth. These are Satan's angels. And they have come here to corrupt mankind. And that is why God says in the very next verse that I'm not going to have this. If that's what they're going to do to my earth, I'm going to wipe it out. And God gives the death sentence to the earth. 120 years and I'm going to destroy it all. Because as you know, as you keep on reading there in Genesis 6, that what happened was that all mankind became corrupted, that every thought of man's heart was only evil continually. And it certainly looked like the enemy was succeeding, but God wiped it all out. And if you've never read the Bible before, you would say, "Oh, great, that's good." Because there was this great rebellion taking over God's earth and taking over heaven, and it looked like God was going to lose everything, and he wiped it all out, and we would say, now everything's back to normal. But then you read Genesis 10 and 11, and you find out that the earth goes back to the same way again, that the corruption starts all over again. Now, you might be thinking, I hope you're thinking, well, this is all pretty interesting. But what in the world does this have to do with me and the world I live in? And the answer is this, that this story, I think, explains the Bible. Because you see, what God's plan is and what God's will is simple. That God's plan is to reconquer the universe. That's what the Bible is ultimately about. That God is going to reconquer the universe. That he is going to restore the order that was lost because of the efforts of Satan. that he is going to eliminate the opposition. He is going to eliminate the rebellion. And he's going to make the universe what it was supposed to be from the start. That's why, for example, we have all of this talk in the Old Testament books about the coming day in which God would establish his kingdom on the earth. Because if you look at things from this kind of high perspective, it certainly looks like the earth is no longer God's kingdom. It looks like the enemy has taken over. And so God begins to say, no, I'm going to establish my kingdom among men on the earth, Daniel chapter 2 and other places. And perhaps we ought to just be a little bit more accurate here. The fact is, and you and I know, that God never lost control of the universe to begin with. It would appear to people like you and me that maybe God had lost control, but the fact of the matter is that he never lost control of anything. And when we say that God is going to reconquer the universe, what we mean more accurately is that he is going to reassert his control over the universe so as to make it absolutely clear to everyone, and I mean everyone, everybody who lives on the earth and every being up in heaven, that God is going to make it absolutely clear to every living creature that this universe belongs to him. And that, friends and brethren, is what the death and resurrection of Jesus was about. You know, sometimes we think, well, Jesus came and died on the cross so I can go to heaven. True. But there's a lot more to it than that, right? You see, what Jesus did when he came to this earth is he was engaging in the battle. And he came and he fought the decisive battle. He won the decisive victory. Because what Satan had done is he had been recruiting people all throughout history. And the thing in the Bible is this: that once I join Satan's side, I can never unjoin it. Once I join the side of the enemy, I can never get out. But what does Jesus do? He comes and he breaks the power of Satan so that those who want to get out can get out. He broke the power of the enemy, that Satan cannot hold you and me in the kingdom of sin and death any longer. You may remember as we were studying the Gospel of John, in John chapter 12 and in verse 31, right before Jesus went out to the garden, he said, "Now judgment is on this world, and the ruler of this world will be cast out." When I go to the cross and die and I'm raised again, it's going to break Satan's power once and for all. In Colossians chapter 2, the Apostle Paul said in verse 10 that in him you have been made complete, and Jesus is now the head over all rule and authority. In other words, the picture of Jesus in the Bible is that he came to the battlefield. This is the place that Satan wanted to take over. He wanted the whole world to be his. And Jesus came to the battlefield, fought that battle, and destroyed the power of the enemy on his own turf. And Jesus' death and resurrection was the turning point of the war. You hear glimpses of this all throughout the New Testament. For example, in Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 20, that this is the power that God brought about in Christ when he raised him from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly places, far above all rule, all authority, all power, all dominion, and every name that is named, not only in this realm, but in the one to come. And he put all things in subjection under his feet. And there is a picture, not of just Jesus died so that I can go to heaven. That is the picture that Jesus came and conquered the universe. And he is now enthroned as king above anything in this universe with God himself as the exception. In chapter 4 of the book of Ephesians, in verse 8, the Old Testament text that Paul quotes said that when Jesus ascended on high, he led captive a host of captives. That like a Roman general who went and fought a war and collected all of the survivors as prisoners and took them to where they could never hurt somebody again, Jesus did that when he was here. That he disarmed those hosts and led them into captivity. In Colossians chapter 2 and in verse 15, over where we were a moment ago, it says that Jesus disarmed the rulers and authorities and made a public display of them. That he took away their power, he took away their weapons, and made the whole world see that they are nothing. In 1 Peter chapter 3, Peter says in verse 22, that Jesus is at the right hand of God, having gone into heaven after angels and authorities and powers had been subjected to him. So you see that what Jesus did is part of this big picture. That he came to destroy the rebellion. He came to set those people that Satan had taken into his kingdom, to set them free. And the Bible says in 1 Corinthians 15 that that work is not over. In 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 24, that at the end he will hand the kingdom over to God when he has abolished all rule and authority and power, for he must reign until he has conquered all his enemies. There will be enemies that pop their heads up from now until the end of time, but Jesus is going to conquer every one of them. Satan is going to continue to try his rebellion. Even though his power has been broken, his back has been broken, as it were, Satan still wants to try, and he is going to try. He's going to use the nations of men. He's going to use everything that he can, but the fact is that he's already been defeated, and everything he does from now until the end of the time will only fail, and Jesus will then, after he has conquered it all, deliver to God a universe that is just like it was at the beginning, completely in order, all the enemies gone, order restored. And so here's the simple question that all of this raises for you and I today. It's a very simple question. And I do believe that perhaps in some sense this encapsulates the biblical message. The question is, whose side are we on? Whose side are we on? There's the side of God, and there is the side of Satan, and that's the only possibilities. There is no middle ground. There are no other options. There is this war. You remember how Paul put it in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and in verse 26? He says that maybe God will lead these people to repentance and to the knowledge of the truth, that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been held captive by him to do his will. People who join the side of Satan, people who decide that I'm not going to live how God wants me to do, when we decide to sin, we join the enemy and we become held captive by Satan. Jesus has broken that power so that we can get out and join his side once again. In Ephesians chapter 6, you remember the familiar words in verse 12. Our struggle, what I have to do in this world, what my life is about, it's not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. That's what my struggle is about. I'm fighting against that. And what Jesus has said is that I'm going to give you the victory. That if you want to be on my side, you will be victorious over them, that they cannot harm you. In Ephesians 2 and verse 1, Paul said, when we were sinners, that we all walked according to the prince of the power of the air. The prince of the power of the spiritual realm. That we had joined that side. But now Jesus has made it possible for us to get out. And in 1 Thessalonians 2, the Apostle Paul reminds us there in verse 2, that, or 2 Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians 2:12. Let's try that one. That he calls you into his own kingdom, Paul says. That's what God is doing. He's calling us into his kingdom. He's calling us out of the kingdom of darkness and into his kingdom. You ever wonder why the Bible spend so much time telling the story of the Exodus? I mean, there's a lot of things that happened in the history of Israel, but we have an entire book just about dedicated to that one event. Why? Because that event is what God is doing on the universal scale, that he is now leading a new Exodus. That just like Israel had become captive in the land of darkness and death in Egypt, and God brought them out with his power, so God is bringing us out through the gospel of Jesus Christ out of the kingdom of Satan and back onto his side. And he does so with the death of the Lamb. And that chapter in 1 Corinthians 15, as the Exodus goes on, it will result, just like it did the first time, in the destruction of the enemy once for all and the freedom and life of God's people forever. And so my goal this morning has just simply been to paint this picture. And I hope that all of us will come to see that we are part of it. That we are part of this cosmic warfare, this great battle, this great struggle that has been going on ever since before Genesis chapter 3. And God is simply asking you and I the question, whose side do you want to be on? We have to make a choice. And we make that choice by accepting the gospel of Jesus Christ and living accordingly.